Rural schools and why they matter to the communities they serve. In recent years, the focus and the effort to improve the public education system in the U.S. has been on the challenges facing urban schools. But have the policies developed around that effort acknowledged the special role that rural schools play, particularly in their own communities? I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we'll explore this dynamic and how it's affecting one of the most rural states in the nation, Maine. We'll look at the history of rural education, the changes that are being imposed by the state and federal governments, and at the future of rural schools in our state. And as always, we want to hear from you. What do you think should be done to support rural schools, as many face shrinking enrollments and budgets? The special challenges of rural schools in Maine. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. For some, picturing a small rural school conjures up images straight out of Little House on the Prairie. But rural schools are not all one-room schoolhouses. They can and do play vital roles in the communities they serve. Today, we want to learn more about rural schools and what they can mean for the communities in which they're located. Joining me in the studio, Mara Tekin. She's an assistant professor of education at Bates College and the author of Why Rural Schools Matter. Joining us from our studio in Bangor, Gordon Donaldson. He's professor emeritus of education at the University of Maine, where he taught graduate-level courses for 27 years. He's also the former principal of Ellsworth Junior and Senior High School. And, of course, we want to hear from you. The number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, both of you, to Maine Calling.
Thanks for having us.
Mara Tekin, I'll start with you, Mara. I was talking with a colleague before the show about the subject today, and I explained it was rural education, and there was sort of a pause, and she said, well, what do you mean rural education? Education's education, and how you describe its location shouldn't really matter whether it's urban, suburban, or rural. That's just a descriptor. Why does rural education, I guess, deserve its own consideration as
sure.
a topic?
That's a great question. So first, just to give a little bit of background, I'll give you some numbers. About one out of every four public schools is rural. One out of every five students is considered rural. So this is about 10 million children. In Maine, actually, the proportion is even higher. So half of all of our students are rural. So this is a huge population. And when we, when we think about education debate or education policy making, this is a population of students that's mostly missing from conversation. People talk about urban education. They don't talk about rural education. But we know that rural schools are really important, both for the education they provide to their students and also because these schools play really important roles in their communities. They're really important to the vitality and sustainability of rural communities. But there are a lot of recent education policies that can have unintended consequences for rural schools or can actually seek to close rural schools.
List a couple of those, if you would.
The most obvious example is consolidation. And this is a practice of collapsing small schools and small districts into larger schools and larger districts. And what it usually leads to is the closure of rural schools. What people in rural communities often fear is that because the school and the community are so tied together, when the school goes, the community goes. These schools are vitally important. They're important to the children they educate. They're important to the communities surrounding them. And we really need to start pulling people, more rural people, into the dialogue about education.
So, and help us define the term rural school. Is Mount Ararat and Topsom, and Gordon, feel free to jump in if you want to help with this. I know you're familiar, obviously, with a lot of Maine high schools, but I know there, for example, that there are any number of different ways that the federal government might even describe what constitutes a rural school.
Right.
Yeah,
go ahead, Gordon.
Go ahead. I'll take a shot at that one, Keith. The federal government is, as generally this census is defined, rural in terms of population density. So for a long time, any community under 2,500 was labeled rural, and have gone through a number of different iterations of that. But I would just add this to the conversation. In the history of schools in Maine, obviously, is largely rural, and it's still rural in the sense that geography keeps our has spread our population out. There's a big chunk of our state that doesn't have anybody living in it, essentially. And so many of the policies that were viewed over the past century as improvements in public education were designed to fit urban situations or situations where the density of the population was greater than it typically is in Maine. So another reason why this issue is critical is we've not had far-sighted policies and laws that have understood that geography is a major variable in how well we deliver education here. 60% of the population of Maine lives within 30 miles of the interstate. That's another way to think about what's rural and what's not rural. Another way to think about it is the centrality of a rural school to its community. And I kind of like the notion of community schools as a way to think about this. And community schools can be rural, urban, suburban. And so I'll leave it at that.
I want to stick with the history a little bit here so we know from whence we come. Why has the focus been on urban schools? Is that because that's where the problems really were, or that's just where the sort of the political will came from?
So there's a long history of thinking about rural education as a problem. A lot of this goes back to the early 1800s when our country started to rapidly industrialize. And this kicked off, the farming industry kind of fell, and this started a wave of massive rural out-migration. And so business leaders, political leaders were really concerned about the state of rural education. They were worried that teachers, there was no standard for teacher training. They were worried about facilities that weren't, that were inefficient. And so rural schools also became labeled as a problem. This is a problem of rural education. And this started a wave of policies like consolidation, like the standardization of teacher preparation, like looking at standardizing curriculum that have really, as Gordon indicated, have really continued to this day, where the emphasis has been trying to find a one best system that fits cities that will also lead to more efficient education in rural areas.
Yeah. Gordon, did you want to answer?
Here's a good example of that. I've just published a book on the history of Maine schools from between 1900 and 2000 that has a lot of illustrations of this in it. But one of them was in the 1920s. There was a push for arts education, which is a good thing. And the newly minted Maine Department of Education as of 1923 came out with a model for that presumably we were all to follow throughout the state. And the model was that you needed to hire a music supervisor for your schools. Now, most schools were served a single town, and the model was picked up and used in Bangor and in Portland and in Lewiston and in Auburn and so on, but it had no relevance whatsoever, couldn't afford it, and it wasn't necessary in most other places in the state. And the same thing tended to be the case whenever there was an innovation of this kind. You needed to have a supervisor hired for it. Certainly was the case when we started busing kids, which was critical to future consolidation.
Today, we see these sorts of policies that seem better written for urban contexts. So No Child Left Behind was passed in 2002 under President Bush. It led to a wave of testing students standards and accountability movement. But as a part of that, there was also a highly qualified teacher provision which said that all teachers needed to have a bachelor's degree, they needed to have a teaching certificate, and they needed to have demonstrated competence in the area they're teaching. So this sounds like a great idea, but when you look at rural communities where you might have a teacher that is teaching a number of different subject areas, the way that this demonstrated competence was kind of operationalized by the government, you know, it usually meant that you needed to have majored in the subject area. And so in a rural area where you've got a teacher maybe covering three different subjects, it's hard to find teachers and hire all the teachers it would take to be in compliance.
All right, I'm going to play devil's advocate here and suggest that maybe the use of rural or urban are sort of substitute words, meaning poor. That is, when there's I think there've been a lot of studies that show, you know, that you don't have to be a PhD in education to know that in wealthier communities, schools tend to do better. There's more support than in poor communities, and that in inner cities tend to be there's poverty's an issue as in rural communities. Why are we talking about it in terms of geography instead of Mara and income, for example?
Well, I think both of these things matter. First thing we're talking, we are talking about both because we know that many of the ruralist schools are also the most impoverished. So there is that link between poverty and between geography. But there are also special considerations and concerns for rural areas. So just the fact that you do not have as many teachers that you could possibly hire to fill all these positions.
So recruiting is an issue.
Recruiting is an issue. Mm-hmm. Busing is an issue. So there are specific challenges that come with distance, that come with low populations.
Parent involvement, is that an issue when the family lives, 15 miles away as opposed to walking down the street?
Absolutely. It speaks to a structural barrier there, right? That parents mm-hmm. might not be able to get to the parent-teacher conference because they don't have the transportation to do it, or it would just take so long. On the flip side of that, we often find that rural schools and rural communities can have a very close relationship. And so there often are a lot of very willing parents who really want to be very much involved in their children's education and in the life of the school.
So
I think that's
– yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to add that in the research on consolidation nationwide, that we've found that it first of all doesn't tend to save money over the long haul, but number two, that in terms of its impact on children's learning, separation from family and community that you've just alluded to, Keith, is a critical variable. The parental involvement, particularly with kids who have difficulty learning or who are not apt to learn as easily, is essential. And so removing the school from the community and separating it by distance and a number of other things from parents has a huge impact on how well we're doing with kids.
You also have parents who or communities that feel they're getting the short end of the stick in some of these consolidations. They're paying too much, and they don't have enough say, so they don't feel invested in the school that their kid's attending. Is that part of it as well?
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah. And I'd just add one more little anecdotal but important piece of information about Maine policy. When EPS, which is the Maine school funding law, went into effect early in the century, it set up what's known as market areas to vary the amount of money that schools were permitted to spend for various purposes. And rural areas generally have received less subsidy from the state in this formula in one way or another than more heavily settled areas, which means in Washington County, for example, they are systematically underfunded in terms of hiring teachers. Teachers are expected to not make as much in Washington County as they are in York County. And it's very difficult to recruit somebody if you're paying 20% less.
Sorry to interrupt. Before we go to a break, though, I want to focus in on what you're both saying. Are you advocating, and Mara, I'll start with you, different treatment for rural schools, acknowledgement of their problems, or revamping the entire approach to education to accommodate the special problems of rural schools, urban schools, suburban schools, charter schools?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what I would be advocating is, there are certain structures in place that make it more difficult for rural schools to be able to meet the needs of all of their students. And so I think addressing some of those is crucial. But I think what I'm also advocating is a more contextual approach to thinking about policymaking, where we have policies that are more specifically tailored to particular contexts, both the challenges they face, but also the kinds of assets they bring. The fact that in rural areas there is such community involvement, playing on that, using that, and then protecting that through our policies.
So does that extend into curriculum as well, or are you talking more about state policies around consolidation centers?
Both. If we look at curriculum, there has been an increasing standardization of curriculum over decades, where, what's taught in one area is very similar to what's taught in another area. One way of thinking about that is that it makes the education more equitable for students. But there's also a lot of good research to show that when a curriculum is grounded in the local context, kids are more involved, the community is more involved, there's benefits for everybody. So there is this teaching component, too. It's not just about the structures and organizations of school.
Gordon Donaldson, real quickly, how do you come down on this? Are you saying that some of these federal and state policies should be changed to help rural schools?
Well, I would agree with Mara that they need to take into consideration the fact that that conditions within rural schools are substantially different from those in cities and particularly in suburbs, which I think that and the funding mechanisms need to reflect that statewide in Maine. We had one of the most progressive equalization laws in state funding for schools in the early 70s. And the state has backed off from making sure that resources are distributed so that the added burdens of schooling in rural places can be funded, not just by the poor communities that we find there.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll talk much more about this. And we also want to hear from you. 1-800-399-3566 is the number. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Medical Center, getting people back to where they belong, home. Learn more at mainemedicalcenter.org.
This week, Morning Edition brought you stories from the series Living Cancer.
It's not just one number that you can give to a patient. You can't say to a patient, you've got 12 months left to live, like in the movies.
Every day you hear reporting that goes beyond the day's news. Tune in to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
You can join us for Morning Edition weekday mornings from 6 to 9 right here on MPBN. All Evergreen sustaining supporters of MPBN have a member card, and now there's a new version of the MPBN member card mobile app for both Apple and Android devices. With the MPBN member card mobile app on your smartphone, you'll be set to save no matter where you are. It's easy to locate the closest participating businesses and restaurants. Everything you need to know is available with just a tap on your phone. You can also show your phone on the spot to redeem the offer. No need to even carry the card with you. Go to mpbn.net for all the details.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Rural Education. With me in our studio, Mara Tekin. She's an assistant professor of education at Bates College and author of Why Rural Schools Matter. Joining us from our studio in Bangor, Gordon Donaldson. He's professor emeritus of education at the University of Maine, where he taught graduate level courses for 27 years. We invite you to join the conversation as well. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And on the line with us now is Todd West. He's principal of Deer Isle Stonington High School. Principal West, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Give us a quick descriptor, if you would, of your school, where it is, and how many kids it serves, et cetera.
Yeah, certainly. So Deer Isle Stonington High School has a current enrollment of a little bit less than 120 students, and that's in grades 9 through 12. And we are the high school of a local school district that has a K-8 school and serves students in Deer Isle and Stonington. And then we also receive tuition students from some of the surrounding towns on the Blue Hill Peninsula who have high school choice.
Sure. And, fair to say that it's a culturally, it's a longstanding fishing community. That's kind of what you do.
Absolutely. Stonington, the last several years, has been the leading lobster port in the state of Maine, landing upwards of $40 million worth of lobster. And we also have a really vibrant and thriving arts community on our island.
What would you say is the biggest challenge facing your school right now?
I would have to say that the biggest challenge facing our school is when I came to the high school 8 years ago, we had a serious problem around students graduating from high school, or more accurately, not graduating from high school. And at one point in 2009, we had a 57% graduation rate, which was the lowest in the state. And we've made some really tremendous strides. The entire school and community has pulled together. And the last 3 years, our graduation rate has been up over 90%. And so we're really pleased to see those results. But we also feel a sense of obligation that if our students are earning diplomas, we need to make sure that those diplomas mean something and that the students are prepared for whichever post-secondary pursuits they have in mind. And so our challenge right now is, how do we engage students in a curriculum and an education that's relevant to them and engages them and also prepares them for a multitude of post-secondary options?
So I'm sure you might have heard some of the conversation that we started here before the break around the special challenges of local schools and how state and federal requirements, though well-meaning, intended to improve the education of everyone, don't always, accommodate the special hurdles that rural schools face. How would you weigh in on that?
There's certainly some truth to that. One of the things that comes to mind specifically, I know that earlier on the show you talked about kind of the highly qualified teacher provision of No Child Left Behind. There was another provision of that if schools didn't meet certain performance benchmarks over a period of time, that their students would have the option of school choice, and that was clearly written with an urban audience in mind. And, you know, if you don't like your school, you can move to the neighborhood school a couple blocks over. In our case, that would mean students moving at least an hour away, traveling an hour each way to go to another public high school. And so the concept of school choice as a incentive for parents really doesn't fit in the rural context. On the other side of the coin, I would say being a small community-based school has as many advantages as it does disadvantages, and schools that are really committed to serving their kids can leverage those advantages to make the educational process better for the students, for the school, and for their communities.
As compared to some other school districts, though, you're sort of close together or part of a community. Are you far flung on the island there, or are you close to the community you're serving?
We're very close to the community that we're serving, and one of the benefits of being on an island is that it has such clearly defined boundaries and borders, and to define the community of the island is pretty clear because it's where the land is. And once you're in the water, you know that you're in a different community. Yeah. Although that certainly is a connection to our community. A lot of our residents obviously make their living on the water, but our schools are rooted in our communities. They serve as a community center in a lot of different ways, and there certainly are events that are put on by the school that help define our community. In a lot of rural eastern Maine schools. The high school basketball season kind of draws people into the school who you don't see in the school any other time of year. And then, you know, some other events like prom and graduation really help to define the community that the school is in.
I knew that basketball would come up as part of this.
As we're, it was that time of year.
It is upon us. Principal Todd West, thanks for joining us here, and feel free to stay here with us. Yeah, Gordon.
Yeah, I was just going to add, and Todd said it very well, but that one of the struggles in for rural communities and rural high schools is graduation and what graduation means. And historically, it hasn't been associated necessarily with going on to college. In the past 30 years, there's been a huge push to raise aspirations, and aspirations have been defined as going to college. Todd's communities are places where young people have options without going to college, and the fishing is a real choice, and he could go into more detail about that. The same thing is true in a lot of other rural areas, there's a real difficulty that schools have if they define the end product as college. By definition, if my kids grow up in a rural community and I'm not too sure I want them to go somewhere else, I'm not too sure I want them to go to college because that will lead them to go somewhere else. And it raises sort of fundamental questions about the survival of communities. Todd's school has done a fabulous job at relating high academic standards and learning to the issues right there on Deer Isle. And there are a number of other places in Maine where the same kind of place-based education has made a huge difference for kids.
All right, I'm going to bring in a few calls if we can here. We're going to go to Cherryfield and Peter. Hi, Peter. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hey, hi. Peter here from Cherryfield, and I want to really applaud all of your guests. They're right on that rural small schools really work. They are the soul, as we have found out in our community, of our community. We successfully withdrew from a district last year, one of the few small towns in the state to do so, and we have found that our little school just flourishes. It has attracted a lot of community volunteer effort, so that we've got a lot of sort of free resources that are enriching our small school. We have large turnouts of the whole community whenever there's any event going on in the school. The gym and all is full. We are a school that has increased in numbers just because we are seem to be so successful that some families from the surrounding towns are actually bringing their kids to us to enroll. The challenge, of course, is the state's view on consolidation and the state funding for rural schools. Some of your guests said it right when they said that, you know, down east schools, small rural schools are underfunded and undersupported by the state. So
yeah. Peter,
right.
Thanks.
You guys, all of your guests are right on.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Help us put this in a national context about consolidation. We tend to think of Maine's school consolidation as this new and isolated thing, but there have been experiences elsewhere. Mara, how would you contextualize it, I guess, in this case? What have other areas seen?
Right. Well, first thing I'll start off by saying is that I think it's important to also look historically. School consolidation is probably the oldest school reform that we have. We have been collapsing small schools and small districts into larger schools and larger districts for two centuries now. And so what we're seeing today is part of a longstanding pattern. A lot of states right now have consolidation legislation in play. Down south, they tend to have more of a mandate structure. So where I did my work in Arkansas, if you as a district drop below 350 students for more than 2 years, you're consolidated, you're forced to consolidate with another district.
So it's on automatic pilot there.
Basically, yeah. So, you know, it's up to the school then to find, or the district to find another place to consolidate with. And that can lead to all sorts of political wrangling, as you can imagine. But so, you know, there and right now there's a lot of efforts to try to get that repealed, repealing Act 60. And so here in Maine, it tends to be left up to voters. But there are a lot of incentives in place, too, for districts and schools to want to consolidate. There can be financial benefits. So even in places where there might be more local vote or voice in the process, there are a lot of structures that keep consolidating consolidation happening.
All right, let's go to Fort Kent. We'll take it away from the coast here. And Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm an administrator at the University of Maine at Fort Kent, and I find this conversation very intriguing. And we've recently just undergone a strategic planning process on our campus where we've defined our campus as a rural university. So, I do appreciate, well, Fort Kent is definitely rural. I do appreciate the definition that your panelists are using in defining rural schools, and going above and beyond just the geographic context. But when we were planning and defining ourselves as a rural university, we also took a good look at what are rural attitudes, values, approaches to solving problems, and the kind of people that live in a rural context, in a rural community, and how that affects their education. So I applaud the definitions being put forth by your panelists.
All right, Scott. Thanks for joining us. Any comment, yeah, Mara?
I really appreciate you bringing that up because, you know, as we said, there's these multiple definitions of rural that are sort of operationalized by the government, but a lot of people feel that those kind of definitions are misguided. They tend to think of rural as a residual category, so what urban is not. And a lot of people feel like it's really much more about identity, about ties to place, about ties to other people. And, you know, so for my research, I actually use this, you know, do people self-identify as rural? Right.
So they're very unapologetic at Fort Kent. I guess they're saying, yeah, we're rural. In fact, it's a positive brand.
Exactly, and it's very much a part of our identity and who we are.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to let's see. We'll go to Robin in Pembroke. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Hi.
Washington County was mentioned as being underfunded, but there are very small rural schools there that are excellent, and I mention Whiting Village School only because I did a temporary community-based project with them a couple of years ago. I'm just wondering if the researchers are looking at individual schools that are obviously doing something really well as a research topic and finding out, you know, what are they doing well there and what's making it work so well in that location.
Gordon?
I could weigh in on that one. No systematic research, Robin, but about 15 years ago, a group of concerned citizens and educators formed the Maine Small School Coalition, and it's been active in Washington County. And the idea there was to bring together small schools, many of them are rural, and share those both the struggles and the accomplishments within the group, in the notion that we'd then be spreading good practice through the small school network in the state, which incorporates an awful lot of schools. It's been a struggle, frankly, to keep enough sort of public consciousness around the efforts of the Small School Coalition. The group has actively tried to influence legislation in the last 10 years, and I think quite successfully. But it's an uphill battle.
All right. Well, Pembroke's on the list. Sorry to interrupt
right.
you, but we're going to take a short break. Whiting, sorry, is on the list. We'll take a short break. And when we come back, we want to hear more from you, of course. The number is 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Kent's Hill School, an independent college preparatory school in central Maine committed to helping each student make a difference in the world. kentshill.org.
I remember the moment we were taken in Libya and we were asked to lie face down on the ground. And I remember thinking, will I ever get my cameras back? I mean, which is the most ridiculous thought when you're about to die.
On the next Fresh Air, photojournalist Lindsay Addario tells us about working in war zones. It's the subject of her new memoir, It's What I Do. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock here on MPBN. And coming up at 1 o'clock in just a few minutes, Speaking in Maine takes us to the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport. The speaker is Syed Hussein Mousavian. He's the author of Iran and the United States, An Insider's View on the Failed Past and the Road to Peace. That's coming up at 1 o'clock in just a few minutes right here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what does the future hold for rural education in Maine and throughout the country? With me in the studio, Mara Teakin. She's an assistant professor of education at Bates College and the author of Why Rural Schools Matter. Joining us from our studio in Bangor, Gordon Donaldson. He's professor emeritus of education at the University of Maine. He's also former principal of Ellsworth Junior and Senior High School. We also still have with us Todd West, principal at Deer Isle Stonington High School. We want you to join the conversation as well. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Let's go to Allagash and Chase. Hi, Chase.
Hi. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to call in and comment because this is an issue that's been very important to me for a long time now. It's very near and dear to me. Where I'm from in Allagash, Maine, and I'm 24 years old. My family's been there for many generations, though. And if you know anything about Allagash, we have a very unique little culture in our community. And as the world has changed and our students have no longer been able to go to school there and stay there, that's really precipitated the loss of our culture and a great loss to our community. And so, you know, I often hear these things, and it just seems like they occur to me under a paradigm that we need to shift. It's all about efficiency, and we're not talking about what we actually live our lives for, what we live our lives for here in Maine. You know, I want to live in the community that my family's always lived in, and I want to be able to raise a family there. But as a young person, it's difficult enough to get somebody that I might share my life to do that, let alone if the school that our five-year-old children would have to go to would be 30 miles away. And so it just seems to me if we're going to operate in this efficiency paradigm, then we should do that with everything. You know, we shouldn't be able to drive vehicles that don't get 50 miles to the gallon. So I don't know. I just think that we need to think about these things differently. If we're going to live in a state like Maine that has a number of great reasons for us to be here, then let's make every community one that people can live in and raise a family and not feel all these political pressures and philosophical pressures to move into service center communities and do all the business we have to do in our lives there.
Yeah, and this is Chase Jackson, right? You're Troy Jackson's son. We know the Jackson family from Allagash, obviously very politically active. Chase, what would you propose specifically, though? I understand the sort of you want to have a paradigm shift, as you put it, but what would you say? Are you specifically saying let's reverse consolidation or change the formula, or what would you advocate?
Well, I think it's a complicated situation, and I understand that there are a number of reasons to tighten our belts in many situations, a number of reasons to change the way we do things, and so, you know, that's obviously going to mean changing things in a direction I'm not always going to be preferable to. But I also think that we need to stop just assuming because something costs a little bit more or because it doesn't look the best on paper that it's the right course of action.
All right. Yeah.
I've got a – Keith.
Yes, go ahead.
This is Gordon. This is a – at the end of my history of schools, the book I just published, the Maine Schools, I write about – the fact that we think about consolidation in a sort of 1920s paradigm, and Chase has mentioned the word efficiency, which is used throughout the century to justify consolidation, it made some sense in the 1930s, 1940s to think that you could put a library and put some globes and put new projectors and put specialists in a centralized school and bus kids into it because you had to have sort of the knowledge was stored there. That's not true in 2015. It really wasn't true in 2005. Now the knowledge is everywhere, and it's pretty impressive to see what Maine teachers are doing with resources that allow them to be super teachers no matter where they are. You don't need to have a library with lots of, you know, lots of books in it, because that's not where the knowledge is currently stored. So you could reopen the Allegas school chase instead of having to take those kids down the road to Fort Kent. If you had two or three super teachers who were sort of multi-skilled and able to draw on all the resources that now are available electronically. One last comment: I think the Department of Education ought to be all about trying to spread those pedagogical resources to teachers and kids and families, no matter where they are.
Yeah, Scott on Facebook asks, curious about the role of online learning in rural communities, potential benefits and possible issues with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Gordon pointed to some of the potential benefits. I think it's online learning is it's one of those tools that I think can be done well or can be not done well.
But it also doesn't get you to community involvement. I mean, you can't rally around a web page, you know.
Right. And so, you know, it can't be done in the absence of close relationships with people. And that I think is the real strength of rural communities.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Troy and Glenn. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm a elementary principal at Troy School and also at Walker School in Liberty, Maine. And I'm a former selectman, too, from Montville, Maine. And I think that the question is even bigger than education. It goes to how do we give kids in these rural areas a hope in the future of the rural area, so that what Gordon mentioned earlier about people leaving to go to college and not coming back, but how do we provide more opportunities for kids who do choose to go to college to come back? And I think it's really making these communities vibrant and able to support the schools so that there is a tax base in these communities. So I think it's even a bigger question of how do we view rural Maine, and how do we celebrate the fact that rural Maine is unique and there's great potential there.
Yeah. Gordon, you want to go first?
No, I would second Glenn's thinking, absolutely, and I'd love to hear Todd and Mara on the subject. Yeah,
Todd West, let's bring you in.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I agree, and I think one of the paradigm shifts that schools have to make is thinking about their role in helping communities sustain themselves. You can build a tax base and have a vibrant community if the graduates from your high school are not prepared to then do those jobs. You're not really helping solve the problem long term. And so I think that there's a lot of opportunity that would have tremendous benefit for the students and the schools and the communities by having, you know, selectmen, local businesses, schools, nonprofits, kind of the, you know, all the stakeholders of the community talk about how can we work on this together instead of somehow thinking that they're two separate issues.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn. Let's go to Skip. We're going back to Stonington now. Skip in Stonington. Hi, Skip.
Thank you. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
Well, there's several things I want to say, but I'll try and keep it very short. First of all, I think that the education funding law in the state of Maine is a complete disaster. I think it goes counter to against rural communities for many reasons. One of them is the funding formula basically is to the advantage of larger school systems. On the other hand, a lot of the value of how we value the value of our communities comes from coastal communities whose property is inflated by people who come from out of state. And I have long been an advocate of trying to crank into the education formula some income factor that would, I think, provide more funding for rural communities. The second thing I want to say is Todd West has been a phenomenal success in our high school. And if anyone wants to learn about how to change the culture of teaching, the culture of a school, they need to contact Todd West. And the other thing, just in terms of how we try and keep students in our schools, lobster fishermen now have to get a license. And there's a Eastern Maine Skippers program. And so one of the things that Todd has done is celebrated the fact that these young men and women who go out and get this license that is just as valuable in terms of recognition as someone who's going on to college. And so we celebrate that at graduation time, that these people have, in fact, accomplished something very significant. So that's one way, too, that of keeping people in the community.
All right, Skip. Thanks for joining us. Mara?
Yeah, I just I think that Skip here is touching on something important, and the idea of giving students a choice so that they are prepared to go on to college, to stay within their communities. And as we've been sort of talking about, this is a thorny issue because it's not just about getting kids to stay, but it's making sure that they've got meaningful employment in doing so. And so I think this speaks to the need for policy. You know, we've talked about how rural is missing from education policy. Rural is really missing from most policies. And so this is thinking about economic policy and all of these other factors, too, that can make rural communities vibrant, vital places where kids, you know, might want to go away, go to college and then come back.
Is that just because because we don't have as many representatives in Congress because there are fewer people, et cetera, et cetera? We have two representatives to Congress from Maine because we're so small.
I think that might be a little bit of it. I think there also is this kind of pervasive bias towards urban. You know, we talked a little bit about the rural problem narrative. I think that narrative persists, you know, where there's almost a little bit of like an evolutionary approach. And everyone's just going to, you know, eventually everyone will end up in a city. And there are a lot of people who want to be in rural communities. And, you know, that is who they are. And so I think, it will require sort of rethinking how we do policy and how we think about political voice and representation.
Let's go to Elaine in Surrey. Oh, Elaine just left. I'm sorry. I was just about to go to you, Elaine. Gordon, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that in the state of Maine, our own legislature, representatives from rural communities are outnumbered by representatives from within that I-95 corridor that I talked about before, from Kittery to Augusta, basically, or Waterville, perhaps. So issues have been raised to rectify the issues with school funding, for example, that rural folks see, and they just never go anywhere in the legislature.
All right, let's go to Danielle in Lewiston. Try to work in at least one more call here. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. My question is I'm actually from away, and I was a former educator. I moved to Maine because it was less urban, but I am in an urban area in Lewiston. And I know that there are a lot of challenges with skilled work that could be taught through a VOTEC or a VOAG program, but there are challenges there with curriculum. For example, we have a lot of people who have this great talent, but they don't have a teaching degree and therefore cannot teach through an apprenticeship program through these programs. And I'm thinking a rural area would be perfect for that. And I know there is a need. I've seen the ads, you know, they're willing to give an electrician all the tools to start with. They're that desperate for an electrician in the area. And I'm wondering how that could maybe be brought into these sort of more rural areas where, you know, Shakespeare's great. I was the daughter of an English teacher, but it doesn't necessarily help you keep your house warm or put, you know, indoor plumbing in it. So I'm just wondering if that's something that has been addressed or can be addressed, or what are the challenges that are unique to that?
Yeah.
Can I speak to that, Keith?
Sure. Go ahead, Todd.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there are a couple opportunities at the state level where policy that's not intended to be rural helps that, and that's around the concept of proficiency-based learning and flexible student learning pathways. And so the emphasis is really shifting from a set curriculum that everyone has to take to defining some skills that would be beneficial for everyone, whether they go to college or career, and that it lets the schools and the students and the parents kind of figure out how they're going to get there. And I think it's an opening to allow programs like, you know, like you were talking about, or like we're working on with our Eastern Maine Skippers program, to really harness local community knowledge and skills and let that account for some of the academic outcomes that students are expected to meet.
So Todd, you're saying there is some wiggle room here for rural schools to customize their curricula.
Absolutely. I think that there's a policy framework in place to do that, and to some extent it just takes a little bit of courage to free yourself from what you've always done to approach it that way.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on this issue, Gordon? We'll let you go first here. We've got about a minute left.
Okay, I would just second what Todd said. There is wiggle room, and it does take a little bit of courage. And the schools that are moving forward and taking advantage of the assets they have as small and rural are really need to be encouraged and supported by the rest of us, and particularly by the Department of Education.
Yeah, Mara, are some schools using the sort of federal requirements as an excuse for not being more innovative, or is that too harsh?
I think it might be a little bit harsh. I mean, I definitely think it speaks to the importance of leadership like Todd's to be able to take advantage like we said, have the courage to be innovative and to be locally responsive. I think policymakers, though, too, have a responsibility to also think about the implications of their policies for rural areas.
And with that, we're out of time. Thank you all for being here. Mara Tekin is Assistant Professor of Education at Bates College and author of Why Rural Schools Matter. Gordon Donaldson, Professor Emeritus of Education at the University of Maine. And he's also the former principal of Ellsworth Junior and Senior High School. Todd West, principal of Deer Isle Stonington High School. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Jennifer Rooks answered your calls. We had help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio. Tomorrow on the program, Jennifer and some of our favorite book lovers for part two of their discussion on books that divide us. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.